You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are joined by Daniel Freib.
Hello, chaps. How's it going?
Daniel, how are you, Daniel? You're in Berlin.
Yep, I'm all right. I'm all right.
We're in a square in London. I've hauled myself out of my sick bed. Not very well.
Going beyond the call of duty, aren't you?
A little bit, yep.
Yeah. We're in Golden Square, which is freezing cold, but quite appropriate given it's World Championship week.
Indeed, and we've just watched the men's time trial in the Rafa Cafe here in Soho. Lionel, you and I will talk about that in part one. We've got men's time trial, women's time trial, the team time trials to talk about. We're going to indulge in a little bit of speculation, looking ahead to the road races. And in the final part, we're going to hear from our old friend Francois Thomazeau, who joined us at Tour de France, of course, and he was out in Canada recently for the World Tour races there and spoke to some interesting people, including Tyler Farrar, who's retiring at the end of this season. So we'll hear from Francois. Nice to hear from him again. But before all that, in this first podcast after the Vuelta, Lionel, the news roundup, please.
You said that like it was some revelation.
I'm just a bit slow because, as I say, I've hauled myself out of my sick bed to be
you
here.
You and Peter Sagan both feeling a bit under the weather.
I should have known that. Is he under the weather?
Yeah, he's been a bit under the weather, apparently.
Did he have his wisdom tooth out the other day as well, like me?
I don't think so. I think we probably have heard about that. But let's crack on with talk about the World Championships, because they're taking place in Bergen in Norway at the moment. It's been a fantastic week for Team Sunweb because they did the double in the team time trials. They won the women's event followed by the men's event. It's been a fantastic year all round for Sunweb, both the men's and women's squads. The women lined up with Ellen van Dijk, Corinne Rivera and Lucinda Brand among their lineup, and they beat Bols Dolmans and Cervelo Bigler into second and third places. And then the men basically took inspiration and did the double. Tom Dumoulin, Michael Matthews and Wilco Kelderman were their biggest names in the team, and they beat BMC Racing, who've won the team time trial a couple of times, I think, in the past, and Team Sky, who are yet to win the team time trial. Now, they had Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas on a rare off day in their side. Side? That's more a football rugby term, isn't it? In their team.
They needed to substitute Geraint Thomas at one point, didn't they?
They did, yeah. If they could have substituted Geraint Thomas before that hill, they possibly would have done. The individual time trials then kicked off. The highlights from the races prior to today's men's race. Britain's Tom Pidcock won the junior men's race. Quite an impressive performance by him. He's added that to the junior cyclocross title that he won at the World Championships at the start of the year. He's also won the junior Paris-Roubaix, of course, and that's not him pulling away on a motorbike behind us. He'll still be in Bergen, I assume, doing the road race before the weekend. The women's time trial was won by Annemiek van Vleuten. It's just over a year since she had that horrible crash in the road race at the Olympic Games in Rio. People probably remember that as a real sort of heart-stopping moment on that descent. So a big result for Van Vleuten, beating her compatriot Anna van der Breggen into second place. And it's been the perfect week, really, for the Dutch, because Tom Dumoulin then won the men's time trial, which we're going to talk about in a bit more detail in part one. Just a little bit of off-the-bike news from the UCI's various meetings this week. It's been confirmed that team sizes at the Grand Tours next year will be reduced from 9 riders to 8, and all other races will be reduced from 8 to 7. So that will have some sort of impact on all of the racing next year. We'll no doubt discuss that in a future podcast. The election of the UCI president is also taking place this week, so you may well be listening to this after the election result. So either Brian Cookson or David Le Parchon won that.
Brilliant. That's a good bit of speculation right there. Yeah, is that the end of it, Lionel? Is that the end of the news roundup?
That's the end of it.
That's
yeah.
It.
Yeah.
Nothing else to mention from the world of sport.
Oh, Lionel? Yeah, the cycling podcast Daniel Freib finished a not too bad 12th in the British Speed Golf Open. How was it?
It was fantastic. I was disappointed that you didn't introduce me. In fact, I might have it written into my contract. I'm henceforth introduced as Britain's 12th best speed golfer. golfer until next year when I'm going to be much better.
Were the 11 people who finished ahead of you all British?
No, actually, because the world number one was there, a guy called Wes Cupp from Seattle, I think he is. Anyway, there were quite a few Americans who finished ahead of me.
Yeah, a bit of an Alla Zubeldia performance, though, Daniel. I'm not sure that you'll have set the heather on fire with 12th place. Did people sit up and take notice? Did they remember you from your previous winning?
I'm surprised you haven't been watching Swedish TV. It was covered in great detail in a Swedish TV news bulletin. Mundo Deportivo in Spain, the Spanish newspaper covered it. La Repubblica in Italy. It's been all over the European press. Anyway.
Really, the cycling podcast shouldn't be covering it, but as we have indulged you, Daniel, we ought to explain that speed golf is basically a round of golf, but you have to run between shots. So it's kind of speeding up the game of golf from an unbearable 5 hours to
51 minutes. Bearable 51 minutes, I finished. Was that faster than Tom Dumoulin's time trial today?
I feel we might have already spent too long on this.
Just
next
point
week,
of order, though,
next
Dan,
week
Richard.
We'll do Lionel playing croquet at the weekend.
That'd be slow quite croquet. Fun, yeah. Just a point of order, though, Richard. You described Daniel's result as Alla Zubeldia, but to be fair, Alla Zubeldia, you have to finish in the top 10 for that.
He generally managed the top 10, didn't he?
Anyway.
It was on the verge of being a Maxi Montfort-esque performance, wasn't it? Slightly better than that.
Well done. We're very proud of you. Daniel, you're definitely the best speed golfer among the three of us. The time trial, I mean, it was billed as a two-horse race between Tom Dumoulin and Chris Froome. That's the men's time trial today. And it wasn't really that, because Dumoulin was absolutely invincible. I think we're all looking ahead to next year and the battle, perhaps, in Tour de France between Chris Froome and Tom Dumoulin. And I was looking at the time trial performances of Dumoulin and Froome at the Vuelta and the Giro, both faced in each race Vincenzo Nibali, so I was using him as a bit of a control. And over 40 kilometres, Dumoulin took 2 minutes out of Nibali at the Giro, and over roughly the same distance, Froome took just under a minute out of Nibali. And it's obviously in the time trials where Froome has made the difference in the last few tours, Grand Tours, that he's won. So it creates a very interesting sort of dynamic to the tour. But on the race itself today, I mean, Dumoulin was absolutely outstanding. The rain started falling as he set off, really, and that made conditions quite potentially slippery. There were some cobbles, but he was just in a league of his own, wasn't he?
Well, you mentioned the rain, Richard. It started to fall just as the last wave of riders set off on the course.
Wave, literally.
Yeah, almost. And, I mean, Dumoulin, you wonder, he won by just under 58 seconds. You wonder what his margin of victory would have been had it been completely dry for him. It was a commanding performance. Caps a fantastic year for him because he won the Giro d'Italia, of course, and he was every bit as impressive today as he was in the wine trial in Montefalco during the Giro, where he kind of laid the foundations for the pink jersey victory, and now he's got a rainbow jersey to go with it. But the three talking points that I think we should cover in this section are...
Well, one of them, Lionel, is the noise you might hear in the background is actually Lionel and I are playing table tennis as we as we do this. I mean, you've got your speed golf, Daniel. We're playing table tennis as we podcast.
We're
here.
Not playing table tennis. I'm not sure people will pick up that.
Probably not.
A couple of people are playing on the public table tennis table just over there. If you
sorry,
can hear
Lionel,
tapping,
what are the three topping?
Well, I think
points?
The three topics are one. The fact that the climb at the end made it a really interesting, even though the result really was known pretty much from the first time check that Dumoulin was going to take the gold medal and the rainbow jersey. The climb was spectacular. The crowds were fantastic. 99% of them were absolutely immaculately behaved. There was one quite amusing moment, I suppose, where two security guards or police officers, not sure
burly,
whether they were.
Burly fellas.
They were very burly fellas. They could have been sort of American football players. They took out a spectator who was running alongside. He was running alongside Tony Martin.
Yeah, he was like he was trying to catch him up.
Yeah.
Tell him something.
But the climb itself was spectacular. The big question is, why did the women's race not also finish on that climb? Seems like a missed opportunity. The UCI sort of shot themselves in the foot a little bit there, I think. The climb also meant that the riders had the dilemma of whether or not to swap bikes. They were all obviously setting off on time trial bikes, and then, you know, a number of them swapped to road bikes just for the climb. The first rider off, Alexei Lutsenko of Kazakhstan had a made a real hash of his bike change. There was a sort of red carpet rolled out on the cobblestones, and there was all kind of pre-race speculation about whether the riders would be allowed to have a push, or what would be an allowable push off and what wouldn't. So there was this, the sense that there might be a sort of farcical dimension to it, but actually the decision of whether or not to swap bikes added a dimension of strategy to it that we don't normally see in a time trial, and I thought it worked very well. Just out of interest, Dumoulin and Chris Froome, who finished first and third, they stuck to their time trial bikes, whereas Primoz Roglic, who finished second, very impressive second place, he swapped to a road bike and climbed up and sort of danced up the hill, whereas the other two, you know, stuck to their time trial positions, and I thought that made it a spectacle, you know, to far exceed a lot of world time trial championships. I don't know what you two guys thought.
Well, it didn't look great at first, did it, Lionel, when, you know, the red carpet came out and it looked as though Lutsenko was riding on Velcro wheels because he got stuck in the carpet. I was half expecting the Astana Swanya to produce the shaken vac. But then, well, it was quite interesting watching the prowess of the mechanics doing the changeovers and the riders themselves. Nelson Oliveira did a very good time trial for Portugal, but it would have been a lot better had his changeover, the bike change, been smoother. And, you know, I bought slightly at the criticism that came from Tony Martin earlier in the week about the course and it not being right that it finished up such a steep climb. That would be valid for an Olympic time trial course when there is only one event every 4 years, and that's the only place that the specialists can compete, you know, for a gold medal in the Olympics. But it's every year in World Championship time trials, so I think over the course of a career, you know, Tony Martin's had a dozen chances in his career to win a rainbow jersey. He's won four of them, hasn't he? So I thought that wasn't really valid, that criticism, in the same way that we've often maligned the fact that the road races haven't been varied enough. And indeed, one could malign that this year's course, road race course, you know, they've gone to the trouble of taking the race to Bergen and Norway, and there is great terrain there for a hillier course, and the course itself doesn't look to be, well, the kind of route that's going to really suit the climbers. It looks more like a puncher, sort of sprinter course. So I thought that it was welcome to have something a bit different in the time trial.
Absolutely. I think it made it very, very interesting. It was the most interesting time trial I've watched maybe ever. You know, it made it unpredictable, very hard to really pick a winner, although in the end, obviously, Dumoulin was the favourite. It was interesting also to see compare the times up the climb. You know, Roglic, who did a bike change, was the quickest, but Dumoulin wasn't far behind. Dumoulin took a lot of time out of Chris Froome on that climb. You get the impression, I think, that Froome maybe just hanging on to his form a little bit after the Tour and the Vuelta, whereas Dumoulin has obviously trained specifically for this. So yeah, all in all, I think it was a great success. And as you said, Lionel, the city of Bergen, the people of Norway deserve great credit because it has looked great. The fans have been fantastic as well. And the team time trial also, I thought, was a great success. It was really good. A word on the women's time trial. Annemiek van Vleuten, she was very emotional after winning. She's not often very emotional. She's had a great season. She won La Course as well, of course. She doesn't like talking about her crash in Rio at all.
I'm not surprised. It was horrendous.
No, but inevitably everybody asked her about it. And, you know, I could tell Seb Piquet did the post-race interviews after the time trial. She's very uncomfortable talking about it. This might just allow her to put that firmly behind her.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it was so such a dramatic crash, and I mean, it was one of those ones where you did fear the worst. I suppose until she got a really big win, there was a chance that, you know, she might be defined by that crash. And, you know, certainly in terms of, you know, how hard it must have been to get over that, this is a fantastic result, you know, just a year and a bit after the Rio Olympics ended so badly for her. But Rich, you've recently released another episode of the cycling podcast Féminin, in which Orla again talked about the difference between women's racing and men's racing. I'm thinking of bunch racing, road racing, but in terms of the time trial, there didn't seem to be any justification for not finishing the women's race on that hill as well, really.
Not at all. Hard to imagine there would have been a different winner, because she looked very good, and she's a very good climber as well, Annemiek van Vleuten. It was, yeah, odd. You know, good crowds again, good atmosphere, it looked like. But when we saw what we saw today, the spectacle of that, you think, well, why? What on earth was the reason for not having the same course?
Especially when the UCI is the body that it doesn't have a great deal of stake in organising road races, and when it then does have an event to organise, it chooses not to showcase the women's sport on the same climb. It was a strange one. I can imagine it not even occurring to them. I can imagine them just thinking, well, the distance is going to be X number of kilometres, we'll just finish in the town along with the juniors and the under 23 races. The wrong decision, really. But Daniel, what do you think?
Is it possible they just forgot? They forgot about the climb. They knew there was something. There was something that they hadn't done when they organised the women's race, and it was the climb. They'd just forgotten to put it in. I don't know. I mean,
At what point would it have dawned on them, I wonder?
Yeah, maybe.
Today, watching the men?
Have they, Rich, have they made a statement on why it was? Is there any technical reason? Is there any conceivable, logical reason why it wouldn't have been, you know... to do with, well, their misguided idea of what it might have done to the results?
I just saw some remarks today that it was logistically and organisationally difficult to use the same climb yesterday, but I don't really know why. Maybe, you know, because there have been other time trials, age group time trials running the other days, perhaps it just made it far simpler to have them all on the same course. But then why not the... juniors up there as well? I don't know. Maybe that's too much, but it's not really, because juniors race up 3 kilometer climbs. So no, it doesn't. It seems a very strange one that they weren't all riding a variation of the same course. But we'll maybe get to the bottom of that. As Lionel mentioned, we have released an episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina this week. We were joined by Tom Varney from Drop Cycling Team. Lots of good stuff in there, including Mark Cavendish talking about why he has been quite a vocal supporter of women's cycling, which is a good interview that Orla did. Team time trial. Lionel, do you have something else to say?
Well, I just wanted to say already we're only sort of an hour or so after the race, and there's a sort of a clamour for all future World Championship time trials to finish on a similar sort of hill. We've got Innsbruck, I think, coming up next year, and then Yorkshire 2019. I think, Daniel, as you said, the key to the World Championships is to vary it, to make a course that favours slightly different types of riders each year. This year it was absolutely perfect. Maybe in a few years' time, when the host town or city or region is appropriate, they could have something similar. But I think to turn it into a kind of almost a hill climb championships year in, year out would be just as wrong as having it on a flat Tony Martin-esque type course. I think the World Championships needs to sort of subtly change things year on year.
Great fun though, wasn't it? Team time trial, also an event that I think has struggled to capture the imagination since it was introduced into the World Championships not too long ago. And it's odd because it's a bit of an anomaly in World Championship week, because it's for trade teams rather than countries. So it's an odd one, and as I say, it's even been at risk of not being supported by the teams themselves. We did see a good field, obviously, on Sunday, and the for the women as well, all the big teams there, and Sunweb did the double. And I think that was a surprise, that in the men's race, well, in both races, actually, it was a surprise that Sunweb were the winners. But also, a really exciting race, a close race, a race where it looked like Sky were going to be the strongest team. They were very quick out the blocks, but really started to struggle when Geraint Thomas struggled on the climb. And again, quite a tough climb on the course, which made it more interesting. And Sunweb kept all, you'd think, Dumoulin would be the strongest guy, but they really rode a very good race. And I think both teams had put an awful lot of thought and practice into it. They kept their riders together for a long time, if not all the way to the finish somewhere, which is the key to riding a good team time trial, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an event though for half a dozen teams, isn't it? That's the problem with it. I think 11 of the World Tour teams took the start line. There are a lot of Norwegian teams. I'm talking about in the men's side. The women's field, probably greater strength in depth in terms of the representation of the women's peloton, but the men, it boils down to the same handful of teams every year, doesn't it? BMC, Sky, Orica, this year Sunweb, Quickstep, of course, Yeah, it's that's there's not necessarily a problem with that. The rest would be kind of making up the numbers, as indeed the likes of Trek and Astana were really making up the numbers. It's a funny event, though, isn't it? It's, I don't know, it doesn't quite fit. It feels like the sort of opening ceremony of the World Championship week rather than an event.
Also,
of
that
great
it's six
prestige.
Riders. When at the Grand Tours we see normally nine, we'll see eight next year. Significant perhaps this year because there will be a team time trial in next year's Tour de France. Stage three is going to be a team time trial, we're led to believe, over about 30 kilometres. And as I mentioned earlier, if there's this expected showdown rivalry between Froome and Demoulin, this victory by Sunweb, you know, that's not necessarily going to tell us how that stage is going to go, but it makes it even more tantalising, doesn't it?
Hi, I'm James Knox of Team Wiggins, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. I started racing because my brother was a cyclist whilst I was a runner, and I generally just became a fan of the sport and wanted to see what it was like racing bikes instead of running. My favourite ride is back home in Kendal. Can do a loop over Kirkson Pass, round Ullswater, back over Shap, back down into Kendal, and then just a little drag home to where I live just south of Kendal. It's got like a lot of nice scenery and a few good climbs, so it's my favourite ride.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to our main sponsor, Rafa. We heard there a little message from James Knox, who has ridden for Team Wiggins this year, off to Quickstep next year. We're very grateful to Rafa for their continued sponsorship of the cycling podcast. Without their support, etc. If you're interested in a trip next year, the Rafa Travel 2018 calendar. I know somebody is interested in a trip, judging by that expression, Lionel. The Rafa Travel 2018 calendar is now live at rafa.cc, including spectacular new trips to Colombia and Hawaii, as well as the classic cycling regions throughout Europe and the USA. Colombia, of course, featured in a recent Rafa film, so if that's whetted your appetite, go to rafa.cc and check out the Rafa Travel calendar for next year. Notice you didn't buy anything in the Rafa Cafe when we were there earlier, Lionel. You stuck to tap water.
I wore rigorously Rafa gear or Rafa shorts and Rafa shirt for the British Speed Golf Open. I don't know if we've mentioned that so far.
God, are we going to be?
Actually, the shorts are fantastic because I could fit... It was a Heathland course, lots of potential for losing balls, and I could fit six balls in the pocket. Amazing. Anyway.
Could speed golf be the new cycling?
Well, as I said on Twitter, maybe they'll invent speed cycling after this.
Yeah, anything's possible. Well, that's great, Daniel. I hope that got plenty of media coverage. And I like the idea of you wearing the Rafa clothing rigorously. That's good. Good effort.
I didn't buy anything in the Rafa Cafe because I'd had two coffees already.
Can let it go. Yeah.
I feel bad now.
No, but don't worry, I spent enough for both of us. Like, I ate enough for both of us in there. Daniel, you had another comment about the team time trial, the much maligned team time trial. I did thoroughly enjoy it the weekend, but you had another point to make about it.
There aren't a lot of team time trials in the calendar. We maybe see a handful of them in a season. I think one nice incentive for the winners would be the opportunity for the whole squad, so anyone representing that team, for them to wear a rainbow jersey in any team time trial the following season. I was reminded earlier today, actually, Laurent Jalabert was commentating on French television on the World Time Trial, Individual Time Trial Championship today, and he recalled that he was never able to wear a rainbow jersey when he was World Time Trial Champion in 1997. I think the World Time Trial jersey, well, that could be worn the following year, was only introduced in 1998. I think Abraham Alana was the first rider who was allowed the following season to wear a rainbow jersey in time trials. But of course, now it's very much a fixture, and now it's one of the main reasons why people want to win the World Time Trial Championship. So that would be one thing. But I think the teams do take it pretty seriously. If you watch, I'm not sure if it's been released in the UK or indeed generally anywhere in Europe, but the documentary that Quickstep had made last year, A Year in Blue, a sort of fly on the wall account of their 2016 season, shows very graphically how seriously they took the World Championship time trial in Qatar last year. So there are a handful of teams that do take it very seriously.
And it's worth, I mean, we saw at the Vuelta on the opening day, you know, those same teams filling the top places, and it's because the BMC in particular do put a big emphasis on it, and that can win you a world title, but it can also be extremely useful in the Grand Tours.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about a jersey for everyone in the team. I'm not sure about that because
I think that'd be a good idea.
What? So somebody who doesn't ride in the World Championship team time trial lineup gets to wear the rainbow jersey in a team time trial
yes,
as well?
Yes, yes, yes.
I think so, Lionel, because you know the investment that the teams make is very much it's a collective investment. It's money that the squad spends on, you know, they have these camps prior to the Team Time Trial Championships, and they, you know, do a lot of work on the bikes and the wind tunnel and so forth. And I think anyone who joins that team is effectively, you know, they are buying into, embracing, being embraced by an organisation that, you know, has been rewarded for all that work that they've done.
Richard's giving me silent grief here. I think this is stepping down the road of giving a rosette to everyone. But I do think at the moment that all the teams get is a sticker to put on their bus or team car saying that they are the world time trial champions. I certainly think some kind of logo on the sleeve or logo on the side, I don't know, something.
Full rainbow, white shorts, okay. Everything. That would look fantastic. All it matters, 9-8 riders all in rainbow jerseys.
Okay.
Each one in a
fantastic.
Different colour of the rainbow. That'd be lovely, wouldn't it?
So when they're riding together, they look like a rainbow.
But they've got to ride in only that order all the way round. They're not allowed to swap positions at all.
No, it's sort of, I don't know if you really understand team time trial. Anyway.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yes, Daniel.
Rich, just, I was going to interject. I can't remember why. I think it was when you mentioned BMC a minute ago, but this felt like an opportune moment just to mention two curious, interesting withdrawals from the World Championships. One by Manuel Quinziato, who was supposed to be riding his last ever race as a professional in the team time trial for BMC, and he pulled out because he felt that his teammate TJ Van Garderen, I think it was Van Garderen who took his place, would contribute more. It didn't work ultimately, but that was a very noble gesture that was rightly saluted by a number of Quinziato's fellow pros. He's going to become an agent, or he is actually working as an agent.
We're going to hear from him actually in the final part.
Oh,
Daniel, you didn't
sorry.
Know this, but,
so I didn't know this.
Francois Thomas spoke to him, but that's fine. Just, I know you've got another point to make, but can I just say one thing on Van Garderen? Van Garderen possibly cost them the gold medal because he was the guy they needed him for the time because they'd lost a couple of men. And he was the guy struggling, and they lost a lot of time in the last kilometre or two of the race. So not saying that Quinziato would have been there, I don't think he would have been, but it was Van Garderen of the guys who finished who perhaps cost them the gold medal.
Another withdrawal from the World Championships, that of John Degenkolb, who pulled out of the German team for the road race. And again, a very magnanimous gesture. He felt that he wasn't going to be in the form necessary to compete on a course that should suit him. But it's been a funny old year for Degenkolb, and indeed it's been a funny old two seasons since his terrible crash what is now Sunweb. Was it Sunweb at the time?
Giant Alpecin.
Giant Alpecin. Yeah, at the training camp in Spain, so at the start of 2016, Degenkolb, of course, almost lost a finger. And since then, yeah, if you look at his results, he has been very consistent, and he rode a reasonable classics campaign, but has not really pulled out many victories. And he cut a bit of a forlorn figure at the start of the Vuelta, I must say, and then pulled out after a few days. I think he was sick. He had it was throat infection or something along those lines. But things have not gone particularly well for him in the last couple of years. I understand that he's still lacking some strength in the arm, well, the hand and the wrist and the arm that were affected in that crash last year. I think he needs to rediscover some confidence, and there's obviously still some physical work that needs to be done for him to get back to his former self.
He's maybe also haunted by his experience in Qatar last year at the World Championship. Do you remember he had a terrible loss of temper? Remember that? He got very frustrated with one of the Belgian riders, I think.
Yeah, they weren't cooperating, were they, with Chase?
It wasn't his finest hour, but he does have a bit of a temper on him sometimes, as we've previously discussed. So looking ahead to the road race, fellas, or the road races, there are obviously road races for the juniors on the 23s, the women and the men. What are we thinking? I mean, it's always hard, when we've not seen a race yet on the circuit, to know exactly what kind of race it's going to be. The women, we spoke to Elisa Longo-Borghini of Wiggle High Five in Italy in the Cycling Podcast Femina. She expects the women's race to be contested by a group of 10 to 15 riders. Giorgia Bronzini is the Italy's fancied rider. She's a sprinter who can survive in the climbs, a bit of a maybe Michael Matthews. And I don't know if Michael Matthews, obviously he was a key member of the Sunweb team, that suggests he's going well. I think he's got a world championship win in him. Could this perhaps be his year?
Well, it could be, of course. It could be. You know, you're straying into speculation here. This is my least favourite territory. But, yeah, the big story is always what kind of rider will the course favour. That's what everyone talks about. And as we said, I think this time last year, Daniel made a very good point that people always kind of get it a bit wrong, don't they? Think this is going to be hard, the hill's going to do this or that, and then the race unfolds in a slightly different way. This year, of course, the men's race has got the run into the circuit, so it's not laps all the way through. It wasn't the first time it'd ever been done, I don't think, but I remember Melbourne Worlds 5 or 6 years ago now had that kind of thing, and it did give it a different feel when the race comes in like that, because on that occasion a group got a very big lead, didn't they? And there was a worry that they might complete a lap and actually, you know, be on the same point on the circuit as the bunch, which of course will be a lap behind. I'm not saying that's going to necessarily happen this time, but it gives the race
anything could happen.
But the point I'm trying to make is that when it's just laps, there's a kind of the sense that the pot of water has been put on in the morning and it just, you know, comes slowly to a boil over the course of the whole day. The rhythm of the race is slightly different, I think, when they have this kind of run into the circuit, and then when they first get a look at the circuit and see how it goes, that's what will shape the way the race goes. Whether Peter Sagan is going to be fit and raring to go, try to win a third world title in a row, he'd be the first rider to ever do that, or whether it will be somebody who's won before, Mikhail Kwiatkowski perhaps, won 3 years ago now, you know, it's sort of course that could suit him, or whether it be somebody new, Michael Matthews or Julian Alaphilippe perhaps. And then there's the whole team dynamic. Daniel, I was looking at the Italian lineup, a lot of talent in there, but not a great deal of sort of, you know, experience. Obviously nobody's had actually won it before, but they've got several options depending on how the course eventually plays out.
Yeah, it looks a really strong team on paper, the Italian team, but they haven't won a medal since 2008, which, you know, back then in 2008 would have seemed incredible, unbelievable if you'd said.
Did they not get a 1-2 that day, Daniel?
They did. In Varese, Alessandro Balan and Damiano Cuniga were finished first and second. And, yeah, since then it's been slim pickings for them. They've not, well, it's well documented and we've talked about it a lot, that Italy has really suffered in the aftermath of that long series of doping scandals, which put paid to some of their best riders. And they've got some very fast riders in there. Elia Viviani, obviously, is their sprinter. So it'll be interesting to see if they work to try and keep the race together for him. I would suggest that they'll also be sending guys in breaks. They've got a lot of guys who would be very dangerous if a break goes early on or even in the sort of third quarter of the race. So for someone like Alessandro Di Marchi will probably go in a break. And then they've got Matteo Trentin. And Trentin, the Vuelta, looked like one of the best riders in the world. I mean, a guy who can climb, a guy who can ride quickly on the flat, and he's very fast in a sprint. My one slight reservation about Trentin is that he doesn't have a brilliant record in hard, long races, or certainly not to date, and he doesn't have that much experience being a team leader in very hard, long races of 250 kilometres or thereabouts.
Also, let's be honest, the calibre of sprinters at the Vuelta was nothing like what the guys he's going to be racing against on Sunday.
But the course, as you said, Lionel, is a bit of a mystery. The climb comes quite early in the lap. There's quite a long run in, about 10 kilometres from the top of the climb, I think, and which usually points to a pretty large group being there at the end. However, the climb itself sort of comes in three parts, and I think it might, after all those laps, it might start to wear people down. And also, if you look at the recent history of the World Championships, I think we all kind of remember, those of us who have been watching World Championships for 20 years or so, we sort of have a tendency to think that a lot of these races end up in sprints when we don't expect them to, that they're never quite as hard as we think they're going to be. But actually, in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had a lot of sort of solo winners and a lot of races that have been fairly fragmented after the final or on the final lap and on the final climb. And so I think that there is the terrain there for people to attack and make it stick. And that even applies to someone like Matthews or Sagan. I think they could conceivably jump on that final climb and decide not to wait for the sprint.
As Sagan did 2 years ago in Richmond. Philippe Gilbert, who we've not mentioned, another one, he said an interesting thing in an interview in Pro Cycling this month. He said the easier the course, the harder the race. You know, when it's a very, on paper, very selective course, sometimes it... There are fewer riders who think they can win, whereas a course like this, there will be lots and lots of riders who will think they can win, and that can make the race an awful lot more aggressive and a lot harder. So it should be a great race to watch. We know that there'll be lots of fans out. There'll be a great atmosphere. It's a very beautiful looking place. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, we know that the crowd will be firmly behind Edvald Boasenhagen and Alexander Kristoff, of course, the two Norwegian riders who've got genuine medal hopes. Boasenhagen, of course, won the final stage of the Tour of Britain recently, arguably the toughest stage of the race. It was a bit of a sprint fest there, not necessarily because the course was a doddle, but because there were so many top sprinters in the race. Viviani won a stage there as well. Caleb Ewan, who I don't think's riding the World Championships, is he? But he also won at the Tour of Britain. But it will be, you know, the crowds will be out in force to see Boasenhagen and Kristoff. And, you know, they've both been not too bad in this phase of the season, if you like. Kristoff had a bad crash at the Tour de France, but then came good, won the ride, London Surrey Classic, you know, looked pretty decent that day. Boasenhagen, of course, won a stage at the Tour and in impressive style, and has, you know, kept ticking over if the Tour of Britain is anything to go by. So, you know, they will be watched, of course, like hawks, but it will always come down again to the might of the big traditional teams, you know, the Italians, the Belgians, possibly the Dutch as well. They're on a bit of a surfing a crest of a wave. And then there'll be the kind of the freelancers, the likes of Sagan, and, you know, then there's the teams in the middle. You know, Michael Matthews is going to be... I mean, this is speculation.
What's got into your line, though?
Yeah, I mean, you could...
All that tap water has gone to your head.
You could probably write down sort of 15 or 20 riders' names that you could say, well, they've all got a really good chance of a medal. It's that kind of race, isn't it?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can still use the code CPAUG20, CPAUG20, at scienceandsport.com to get 20% off. One or two of you had problems with the code. If you do have a problem with it, just let us know at contact@thecyclingpodcast.com or get in touch with Science and Sport directly. But that will get you 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com. So in this final part, we're going to hear from our old friend Francois Thomazeau, who was recently in Canada for the two World Tour races there. He spoke to a few people: Gordon Fraser, retired Canadian rider, Tyler Farrar, Manuel Quinziato, as I mentioned earlier, and we'll hear from them now. So let's over to you, Francois, in Canada.
Well, my name is Gordon Fraser, former professional, of course, and now I direct the Silver Pro Cycling Team out of Montreal. We compete all over North America on the UCI America Tour, and here in Montreal, I do the color commentary.
Can you recall, you know, our listeners, what you did as a pro rider? What was your record like?
Well, I think the highlight of my pro career probably was winning the first stage in the yellow jersey at Criterium International. I also won a stage in the Midi Libre, and participating in the Tour de France in 97 was definitely a big highlight for me. But most of my career, the bulk of my career, was in North America. I raced for Mercury and Health Net almost 10 years in the North American circuit, and definitely made my name here in North America and had some good success here.
We're trying to give, you know, listeners of the Cycling Podcast a little bit of insight on Canadian cycling. What can you tell us about it? Has it changed since you were a pro rider? Has it changed? Is it improving?
Well, that's a good question. I think Canadian cycling has a bit of ebb and flow. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down, but I think the big picture is it's growing. You know, we have some good races here in Canada. The Tour de Beauce is a UCI race. We have the Tour of Delta on the West Coast. Of course, the Gastown Grand Prix in downtown Vancouver. 30,000 spectators at a Criterium, so it's a crazy scene in Vancouver. In terms of the riders, you know, we have five or six full-time riders in Europe now. Michael Woods, seventh place in the Vuelta, which should bode well. We need heroes like Mike Woods. We need role models like that, like I had growing up with Steve Bauer. So with Mike Woods, we have a GC contender now. Maybe he can be going to the Tour de France next year with top 15, top 20 aspirations, most certainly. And in terms of the grassroots, I think, you know, there's still important clubs, the Sport Laval here in Montreal, clubs all across Canada. There's lots of good things going out west with some grassroots programs. So I think the participation level in Canada is at an all-time high, and now it's up to teams like Silver to create that pathway for developing athletes to aspire to pro careers. So things are in place. You know, I think the biggest shortfall we have in Canada is perhaps the corporate involvement. We need more sponsorship. We need more revenue streams to help our athletes to progress in the sport.
It may be a silly question for me, but living from the on the Mediterranean coast, my impression it's easier to ride all year round than it is in Canada. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Most athletes that obviously are targeting cycling as a full-time profession, they need to go to the someplace warmer to ride. I grew up in Ottawa, but I spent all my winter months in Tucson, Arizona. I still use Tucson as my home. But we see, like, my Silver athletes, most of them go to Los Angeles. Some go to Tucson. Some of the East Coast riders go down to the Carolinas and Florida to train. So, yeah, you do have to invest in that off-season. It's very important to get the kilometers in to have a good base for the season ahead. So it is challenging. You know, most of our athletes come out of different sports. I came out of Nordic skiing. There's a lot of athletes that come out of hockey, alpine skiing, speed skating, you name it. Generally, cycling is rare. The first sport of an athlete in Canada, as opposed to Europe, where they're growing up cycling at a very, very young age. So we get athletes from a lot of different places.
Well, that's the case with Mike Woods, who was an athlete in the first place.
Absolutely. He was a world-class distance runner, went to the University of Michigan. See, a lot of our athletes have to go to the States with collegiate scholarships as well. So we're behind the eight ball a little bit in terms of our infrastructure, our sporting infrastructure, but through Sport Canada and their provincial associations, there's a lot of funding there. So, but a lot of Canadian athletes do have to go south of the border to pursue their athletic dreams.
We're at the Grand Prix Cycliste de Montréal. What impact do you think the Grand Prix have been around for 8 years? What impact do you think they have on the future of Canadian cycling?
It's huge. You know, the exposure just for a young, if you're not in Montreal, to see the race live, see Peter Sagan, you see Olympic champion Greg Van Avermaet right in front of you. But this race has good exposure. It's online. On the event website, it's streamed everywhere, it's in TV all over the world. That's what it needs exposure at that level to inspire the youth of Canada to say, hey, look, cycling is a cool sport, I want to try this sport. I'd rather do cycling in the summer than maybe soccer or football or baseball or something like that. So the more races that have this type of exposure on media, on television, on internet, the better cycling has to recruit young athletes.
Here am at the Montreal Grand Prix with Tyler Farrar. Tyler, this is a special day for you. What's happening today?
Yeah, it's a moment you don't think about much when you're a young rider turning pro, but today's my final race after 15 years in the pro peloton on a variety of teams from a variety of places. This is it. This is the end. So one last day of racing.
How does it feel?
It's a bit surreal. It's not a bad feeling. It's, you know, I'm ready for it. I'm happy with the decision, but you know, it's really been an incredible adventure for the last 15 years. Something that not many are lucky enough to experience, and I'm really glad that I had that opportunity. So you know, it's this kind of rolling circus and a rolling bubble that we all live in this world. And you know, today is really my last day to be a part of that circus. It's a little emotional, but like I say, it's a good feeling, and I'm leaving with a lot of happy memories.
Is there any highlight you keep in your mind already from these past 15 years?
There's so many. That's the thing. After a long career, there have been so many great moments. You know, there's of course some victories that were really special. There were some other moments, being a part of the team winning the team time trial in the Tour de France. That will always be one of my highlights. Even just arriving on the Champs-Élysées in my first Tour de France, I think is probably for me the most beautiful moment. But there's so many, just the friendships you make across the years. You know, we're all in the same hotel here at this race, and you're walking through the dining hall and you realize you know 90% of the people in there, and it's kind of funny how that works. It's just been a great experience and a great adventure.
What is the future looking like, do you think? What are you going to do now?
Yeah, I guess it's time for me to figure that out. No. We have a baby on the way this winter, so I think the first step is going to be the baby and figuring out how fatherhood works. After that, we'll see. I have a few ideas and a few things in the works. Nothing's concrete yet. Like I say, I'm looking forward to this next step.
Still at Montreal for the Grand Prix, and another rider riding his last race today, and that's Manuel Pizzato. Manuel, how do you feel? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard course today, so it's not like the easiest race to do as the last one, but I'm happy. I'm really motivated to do this last two races above the Team Time Trial Awards. I wouldn't do one more, in the sense that I'm fairly complete in 16 years. I was able to finish a good level. I think that's priceless, and now I can't wait to start working 100% as agent, as rider manager. I really looking forward to that because I love cycling, I love to stay cycling, and I want to share my experience with the younger guys.
What memories could you keep from this long career? What's the highlights or the highlight?
Bob, if I have to say, like, the moment, like the victory I had on Mur de Grammont 2 years ago, for sure was really, probably was the most special moment, even better than World Championship we won with the team. But I had a lot. I always say that cycling gave me something that not even my parents could give me, because he told me that with discipline and commitment you can get everywhere you want.
So that was Francois Tomzo chatting to a few of the riders in Canada. It's a trip he goes on, I think, every year.
Well, yeah, it's lovely to hear Francois' voice
nice
again, isn't it? I've missed him since the tour. But those two races were on the final weekend of the Vuelta, so they sort of slipped off the radar as far as we were concerned. But Peter Sagan won the Grand Prix de Quebec, and Diego Ulissi won the Grand Prix de Montreal. So, you know, maybe a pointer for the World Championship.
Ulissi actually is a good, maybe a decent outsider. I don't know. Who knows?
In good form.
Yeah,
in good
clearly.
Form.
Yeah.
Rich, also, I should point out that earlier I said that Matteo Trentin is suspect over 250 kilometres. Has won one long race in his career, Paris-Tours.
Well, of course he has. Because he has the Ruban Jaune, which is the prize for the fastest average speed in a race over 200 kilometres, a one-day race over 200 kilometres. So, yeah.
Voila.
There we are, and he's carried his form from the Vuelta, hasn't he? So could be a Good show.
There's so many. They haven't really got.
They've got a lot of options, haven't they?
They haven't really got a. To torture another board game analogy, the Italians haven't really got a king or a queen in their lineup, but they've probably got too many rooks and bishops, and there's going to be some sideways and diagonal manoeuvring, I think, when it comes to who will, you know, you could see a lot of conflict on the road, in the sense that they'll all think
from the Italian team of the world champions.
They'll all ride for one objective, definitely, absolutely, definitely. But I think that'll be interesting to see, won't it? We'll be all looking for signs of who's getting on and who's following the plan, what the plan is. We'll try and decipher it afterwards.
You mentioned the Dutch team, Lionel. Tom Dumoulin, you know, here's a guy who, if you saw him at the Bink Bank Tour, previous to the Eneco Tour, he's a good racer as well. You know, he's not just a time trialist, so he's obviously in cracking form. He knows how to win a race. Tom Dumoulin could be a dark horse. Takes off, and who's going to go with him? Who's going to stay with him?
Well, let's stop naming riders who could possibly win a medal.
Should we have a prediction?
Oh,
come on.
Well, one name. Okay. Go on then, Lionel. You first.
Oh, do I have to go first? I'll say Michael Matthews.
This is the second time this has happened to me this week. I went last out of four people. And, I think I'm still left with quite a good option.
If I was
going to
put some of my own money on the outcome, I think I would choose him.
Michael Matthews?
Yeah, I think so. But I think it's a good... It's not a safe bet, but it's a good bet. It's kind of he'll have reasonable odds as well, so it'd be worth putting a few quid on.
Well, as you know, Lionel, I was going to say Michael Matthews. We discussed this earlier, and he said if I get picked first, I'm going to say Michael Matthews. And lo and behold, that's what he did. And I forgot that conversation. Anyway,
you're like Eddie Merckx telling you when he's going to attack and then attacking.
you're just like Eddie Merckx, the cannibal. a ravenous hunger, never satisfied. Anyway, I'll go for Peter Sagan then, obvious choice. But I mean, if anybody's going to win three world titles in a row, Peter Sagan. Not very imaginative, but there you go.
I'm surprised you haven't tried to claim Sagan as your dark horse. That's what you usually do.
He's a bit of a dark horse, yeah. No one's talking about Peter Sagan, are they?
Daniel, how about you?
I'm going to go, if it's sprintery, then I'm going for Gaviria. So Gaviria is my main
Gaviria.
Name. Gaviria. If it proves to be harder, if the weather's not so good and it's harder than people expect, I think Dan Martin.
Oh, really?
Wow.
When you said pick a name, I didn't know we were going to pick potential winners for different conditions and types of race.
Well, you know, Daniel's thorough like that, isn't he?
Well, there you go. I've just done it.
There we are. Who's going to be UCI president, Daniel, by the next time we're podcasting?
No, I'd be either the English chap or the French chap, I would say, confidently predict. No, I don't know. Latest reports are that it's very close. You know, the great difficulty with the UCI elections is that no one really understands how it works. We, of course, do. We're not going to talk about it now, are we? We're going to talk about it next week. We're going to do a review, not a preview, because a preview will take us into the realms of speculation.
It'll also take us well over an hour.
Yeah.
I will always remember being in Florence for the previous election, Brian Cooks and Pat McQuaid. That was dramatic and as interesting as these things can ever be,
was
I think.
Rich, remind me, was that close?
I think it was quite close, but I can't really remember now the final score.
I can remember it being seeming like a fait accompli.
Yeah, but there was a lot of uncertainty going into it. You know, that's what makes me sceptical about the forecast this time, because I remember going into it, there were really neither side was confident that they would win. I think it was very uncertain. So, who knows?
Well, interestingly, I received an email this week from a sports PR company offering a Brian Cookson interview. As you may remember, I've requested an interview with Brian quite a few times this year, on at least two major occasions. The first time after all of the stuff with Bradley Wiggins kicked up last year. And I won't say he's swerved it, but he's certainly dropped his shoulder slightly, but he swerved it.
We saw him at the Tour de France, and he did then said, "I will give you that interview, Lionel."
And then just in the week of the election, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, it's not the right time to just suddenly, be in a position where we're helping Brian get his last votes over the line potentially. I think we'll take him up on that opportunity if he is re-elected. We've got some questions that I think we would like to ask. So
certainly we do. I think we do. And the question, I guess, well, we'll maybe get to this next week when we've got the election result. But the big question is, will it make much difference? I mean, the UCI. How much power do they have? But anyway, that's all perhaps for next week when we have either a new president or Brian Cookson re-elected, and we can look at what they're promising to do.
Or more likely the week after, because next week we're going to have some cracking races to talk about.
And also we will discuss Brian Cookson's first term then, I think, once we... once we've got a bit more time to do it. There has been quite a lot of race to talk about this week as well. So we should wrap things up. Thank you very much. And Lionel is wrapping himself up as I speak.
Yeah, it's cold, isn't it? End of season chill.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.